Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a trip, a very specific one, to January 17th, 2026.
Right now.
Exactly. And if you're listening, you know the news cycle has been just moving at the speed of light.
Oh, absolutely.
So we're going to hit pause for a moment and zoom in on one city, a city that's become the absolute center of gravity for this entire national conversation. We are talking about Minneapolis.
It really has become the flashpoint, hasn't it?
It absolutely has. And we're not just, you know, giving a news update here. We're investigating a collision.
A collision is the right word for it.
On one side, you have this huge shift in federal policy that really kicked off about a year ago, early 2025. And on the other, you have the reality on the streets today. And what we're seeing in Minneapolis right now, all the protests, the court rulings, the tragedy, it is all the result of that collision.
And to really get what's happening today, you have to look at the whole stack of sources we've pulled. We have breaking news, court rulings from, just this morning. We have a very stern letter from Senator Richard Blumenthal to the DHS Secretary, Kristi Noem.
Okay.
Then there's a major lawsuit filed by the Mennonite Church USA, which actually dates all the way back to the inauguration last year. And we've even got some internal ICE training docs.
Which are fascinating. So our mission today, unpack what they're calling Operation Metro Surge. We need to understand what happened to the sensitive locations protections. You know, places like churches and schools.
Yeah, that's a huge piece of this.
And we need to see how the courts are ruling right now, literally as we speak, on the rights of citizens to push back.
It's a complex picture, but the themes are very clear. It's authority versus oversight. And maybe more importantly, speed versus safety.
Okay, let's dive in. We have to start with the spark, the event that really just set Minneapolis on fire this past week.
The killing of Renee Nicole Good.
Renee Good, also reported as Renee Macklin Good, an unarmed U.S. citizen.
Killed by an ICE agent in Minneapolis just last week.
And this wasn't, you know, an isolated incident in some kind of vacuum. This happened right in the middle of this massive operation. And the political response, it was immediate.
Oh, immediate. And the language is just, polarized doesn't even begin to cover it.
Right.
On one hand, you have the Department of Homeland Security. We have these statements from Assistant Secretary Trisha McLaughlin. She calls Operation Metro Surge the largest DHS operation in history.
The largest in history.
That's the quote.
Yep.
And their framing is very specific. They argue they are delivering on a mandate. The line that stands out is they are there to deport illegal aliens and restore law and order.
So they see the 2024 election results as a green light for this.
A complete green light for aggressive enforcement, yes.
But then you look at source two, this letter from Senator Blumenthal.
Mm.
He's not just anyone. He's the ranking member of the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations.
He has teeth.
He does. And he isn't just asking for a comment. He's demanding records on use of force training. And he points to something just staggering. The agency hired 12,000 new officers in less than a year.
12,000. That's the heart of his argument right there. He's asking this fundamental question. When you scale up that fast, are you prioritizing speed over safety?
Yeah.
He specifically asks Secretary Noem if speed is being prioritized over substance in the training. He basically frames the killing of Renee Good not as an accident, but as a predictable outcome.
An outcome of putting that many new, maybe undertrained agents into such a volatile environment.
Exactly.
And speaking of that environment, let's talk about who is actually on the ground in Minneapolis. Because when I read the NPR report in our stack, I did a double take. It's not just ICE, is it?
No, it's not. And this is what makes Operation Metro Surge so, so different. According to reports, there are about 2,000 federal agents in the city, but it's a patchwork force.
A patchwork.
You've got ICE, you've got Border Patrol, obviously, but you also have agents from the Bureau of Prisons. And there are indications that the DEA and maybe even the ATF are involved.
Wait, hold on. The Bureau of Prisons, you mean the people who guard federal penitentiaries?
Correct. And this is where that training gap that experts are worried about really comes into play. We have a source, Gil Kerlikowske.
The former Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection.
That's him. He makes this really important distinction. He says, look, Border Patrol agents are trained for isolated checkpoints. They work in deserts, rural areas.
Right.
Policing a dense urban environment like Minneapolis is, and I'm quoting him here, very, very different.
Well, that just makes total sense. I mean, if you're trained to watch a line in the sand where anyone crossing is likely breaking the law, that's one thing.
It's a different world.
But standing on a street corner in Minneapolis with U.S. citizens, green card holders, protesters, traffic, That's a completely different skill set.
And Kerlikowske argues that these agents are, in his words, totally unprepared for crowd control in a city.
What does he point to?
He points to tactics like firing pepper balls directly at people or throwing tear gas from moving vehicles. He says those things flat out violate standard policing practices.
So it suggests a force that's operating with more of a wartime mentality.
Than a community policing mentality. That's a perfect way to put it.
And that leads us to this shift in tactics. It's not just about who is doing the arresting, but who they're arresting.
Right.
We're seeing a move away from targeted arrests.
Yeah.
You know, going after a specific person with a warrant to something much, much broader.
Exactly. Experts have a name for them. Kavanaugh stops.
Kavanaugh stops. Explain that.
It refers to brief detentions based on just minimal suspicion, essentially stopping someone because they look like they might be undocumented.
Not because you have a warrant for them.
No, or even probable cause. And the data really bears this out. We have these stats from UC Berkeley's Deportation Data Project. In the first 9 months of the Trump second term, 75,000 people arrested by ICE had no criminal record.
75,000?
Yeah.
That is a massive number. It's over a third of all arrests.
It is. And it really, you know, it contradicts the official narrative that this is all about violent criminals.
Which brings up the question, why Minneapolis?
Yeah.
Why surge there?
And that's where the North Star Act comes in.
This feels like a turf war.
It is a turf war in a legal sense. The North Star Act is a Minnesota state initiative.
Okay.
And it prohibits local resources, so police, jails, data from being used for civil immigration enforcement.
And from the state's perspective, this is about community trust, right?
Yeah.
They want immigrants to feel safe calling 911.
That's the idea. But from the DHS perspective,
they see it differently.
Oh, yeah. From their perspective, the North Star Act makes Minnesota a sanctuary jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. They argue that because they can't just go into the local jail and pick people up, they are forced, and that's the word Assistant Secretary McLaughlin used, forced to go into the streets to find them.
So because the local police won't hand people over, the feds just flood the zone, and the local police are caught right in the middle.
Completely. You have local cops trying to rebuild trust after the George Floyd years, and now you have federal agents in unmarked cars running operations that look like police actions, but the locals have zero control over it.
It must create so much confusion. I mean, residents don't distinguish between a local cop and a federal agent when they just see a badge and a gun.
Exactly. So if federal agents are acting aggressively, it blows back on the local police department's relationship with the whole community.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. And honestly, pretty scary for a lot of people. It's not just about the streets. It's about where these arrests are happening.
The sensitive locations.
For 30 years, there were places that were considered off limits. Churches, schools, hospitals.
That's right. For three decades, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, there was a policy. You just didn't conduct enforcement actions in these sensitive locations unless there was a dire emergency.
Like a terror threat or a hot pursuit of a dangerous felon.
Exactly. But that all changed. And to understand how, we have to look back to exactly 1 year ago, January 20, 2025, Inauguration Day.
The very first day of the new administration.
Day one. We have the documents from this lawsuit, Mennonite Church USA v. DHS. They are suing DHS because on that day, Acting Secretary Benjamin Huffman issued a memo.
And the memo did what?
It rescinded the sensitive locations policy.
Wes wiped it off the books.
Effectively, yes. The rationale given was that they didn't want bright line rules telling agents where they could or couldn't go. They said they wanted to trust agents to use a healthy dose of common sense.
Common sense. That phrase is doing a lot of heavy lifting there.
It really is. Because what looks like common sense to an agent under pressure to meet arrest quotas looks very different to, say, a pastor trying to hold a service.
Right.
And the Mennonite Church lawsuit argues that this rescission forces them into what they call a Hobson's choice.
A Hobson's choice, meaning no real choice at all.
Precisely. Their argument is that their faith mandates them to welcome the stranger, to minister to the vulnerable. But if welcoming an immigrant puts that person at risk of being arrested inside the church, they're trapped.
They either stop ministering, which violates their religious beliefs, or they continue and risk their church becoming a site of federal enforcement.
And this isn't theoretical. We have examples of this happening. You read about Wilson Velasquez.
A heartbreaking case.
He was a father. He was wearing an ankle monitor, which means he was already in the system. He was being tracked. He wasn't hiding.
He was attending a church service.
And ICE agents showed up at the church and arrested him.
While he was in church.
Yes. And the administration's justification would be that common sense says, if you know where someone is, you go get them.
Oh.
But from the community's perspective, it just shatters the idea of sanctuary. It means there's no safe space.
It's incredibly heavy. But let's shift gears to what's happening right now, today, January 17, 2026.
Yeah.
Because there is pushback. People are in the streets.
They are. The protests in Minneapolis have been intense. We have reports of snowballs being thrown at agents. It is January in Minnesota, after all.
Sure.
But also agents responding with tear gas and pepper balls.
And arresting legal observers. That's a key detail. People who were just there to watch and document are getting handcuffed.
Well, they were getting handcuffed.
Yeah.
Until this morning.
This is the breaking news.
This is the breaking news in our stack. Source 5, a ruling in the case Tincture v. Noem. Federal Judge Kate Menendez has issued a preliminary injunction.
Okay, so what does this injunction actually do?
It prevents federal agents from retaliating against peaceful protesters. But Judge Menendez got very specific, which is what's so interesting.
How so?
She ruled that simply following federal agents in a vehicle to observe them, as long as you do it safely, does not create reasonable suspicion for a traffic stop.
That is huge, because that was a tactic agents were using, right? If you follow us, you're obstructing. We pull you over.
Exactly. The judge is drawing a very clear line. She's saying, observation is not obstruction. It's a First Amendment activity. This is a significant check on that common sense discretion we were just talking about.
The court is saying your common sense cannot override the Constitution.
That's the message.
This all raises an important question about the rules of engagement. We have those internal ICE training documents in our stack, the ones about warrantless arrests.
Yes, these are fascinating. They come from a settlement, the Castaña Nava settlement. And they lay out the very technical rules for when an agent can arrest someone without a warrant.
Because normally, you need a warrant.
Normally. To arrest someone without one, an agent needs two things. Probable cause that the person is in the country illegally, and a likelihood of escape.
Probable cause and likelihood of escape. You need both.
You need both. And the training docs highlight that mere presence in the U.S. isn't enough to prove they're likely to escape. You have to look at the totality of circumstances.
Like what?
Do they have a job? Do they have family? A home address? If they do, they aren't necessarily a flight risk.
So, Wilson Velasquez, the man in the church with the ankle monitor. He has family. He has a tracker on his leg. He's at a church service. How is he a flight risk?
That is exactly the legal complexity.
Yeah.
Under the strict letter of that training, it's very hard to argue he was likely to escape before a warrant could be obtained.
Right.
But if the policy has shifted to use your common sense and get the numbers up, those technical checklists, they might just be getting ignored in the heat of the moment.
And that's where all the confusion comes from. If agents are operating on this mandate to surge, are they really stopping to go through a mental checklist of likelihood of escape factors?
The plaintiffs in these lawsuits would argue, absolutely not. They'd argue that the pressure to produce arrest numbers, remember those 12,000 new agents, is just overriding the procedural safeguards.
So tying this all together, what does this all mean? We have these massive forces colliding.
If we pull back to the big picture, what we're seeing is really a test of the entire federal system. You have a federal executive branch with a clear mandate, mass deportation. They've ramped up manpower by 120%. They've removed policy barriers like the sensitive locations rule.
They're going all in.
All in. And on the other side,
you have local resistance like the North Star Act denying them resources.
And you have the judicial branch stepping in like Judge Menendez in the Tincture case trying to put some guardrails back on.
And caught in the middle of all of this are just people. The family in Milwaukee we read about arrested while shopping, even though they were U.S. citizens.
Yeah.
The congregants in that church watching a father get taken away. The people on the streets of Minneapolis facing tear gas.
It creates this atmosphere of just profound uncertainty. When the rules change this fast and when common sense replaces written policy, nobody really knows where they stand. Not the citizens, not the immigrants, not even the local police.
It really feels like we are watching history being written in real time, and the ink is still very, very wet.
And very messy.
So before we go, I want to leave you with one last thought. We've talked a lot about this idea of common sense versus rules. The administration says, trust our agents' common sense.
Right.
But the courts are saying, no, we need to define what retaliation looks like.
It's the classic tension.
It is. So here's the question. If the rules of engagement on an American street corner are based on an individual agent's common sense, but the courts have to step in later to define what is and isn't legal, who was actually deciding where the line is drawn? Is it the agent with the badge in the heat of the moment? Or is it the judge with the gavel months later? And what happens to the people who are caught in that gap between the moment and the ruling?
That is the question that's going to define the next 4 years.
Thanks for diving deep with us. Stay safe, keep asking questions, and we'll see you on the next one.